because sometimes I felt like I'd been on this like nonstop wheel. Like you get your A levels, you go to university, you graduate, you get on a graduate scheme, you get on this career ladder, you get promotions and experiences, and you start progressing, and you earn more money, and you get bonuses, and so on and so forth. And yeah, I really needed to have a think about who I was, what did I enjoy, what were my passions, what were my interests, and actually, what did I want my life to look like?
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Sarah Williams. Sarah is the creator and host of the Tough Girl podcast. She has done her own personal adventures all over the world. She has a mission to increase the visibility of female role models in the media and help women become confident to undertake big and physical challenges. We had a great conversation. Enjoyed speaking with her. Hope you enjoy this conversation with Sarah Williams.
The routine of things. So obviously I finished, you probably saw, I finished my Wales Coast Path walk a couple of weeks ago, but then I was down at Ascot working at Royal Ascot selling silk top hats, very random, and then like a time in London, and then now just finally back at home, time to get some routine organized and sort my life out.
Yeah, well, cool. So tell me about what was your walk? It was the west coast of Wales?
No, it was all of the Wales Coast Path. So it runs from Chester to Chepstow. It's 870 miles. And the Wales Coast Path was celebrating its 10-year anniversary. And so I worked with a guidebook company and the Wales Coast Path to, you know, to walk it, to vlog it. And so, yeah, I did it in 50 days, which was really fabulous.
That's cool. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing that you were going to do that. And that's great. So was that similar to the one you did in Tasmania? Was that, because I saw your blog.
Yeah, so I've worked with Cicero now for the past couple of years. So I've done like the Camino Portuguese with them. The Overland Track in Tasmania in Australia. Then I did like something called the UK Adventure Series last year in 2021, which is where I walked six of the UK trails. So the Anglesey Coast Path, the South Downs Way, West Highlands Way, the Pilgrim's Way, climbed Ben Nevis and did the Great Glen Way. To celebrate 6 years of the Tough Girl podcast, and by doing six adventure challenges, really. So plus also it's quite good to get out there again and, you know, do something, seeing as I haven't done anything for quite a while. So yeah, it worked out well.
Well, that's cool. And so the Tough Girl podcast, you celebrated 6 years.
Yeah, and we're coming up to the seventh year this year, which will be exciting. 4th of August. 4th of August is when it started with 4 episodes.
You say you recorded 4 episodes to begin with?
No. Yeah, so I started with 4 episodes, and then what I do I started for the past couple of years is on the 4th year anniversary, I actually release like, I do 4 bonus episodes, like 4 4 episodes of just, you know, incredible women. Just also, I don't know about you. Do you find August to be quite a quiet month in terms of downloads?
Well, I don't watch my numbers. You know, I'm not a stats person.
Got you. Yeah, fair enough.
I look at my numbers every once in a while. In fact, but yeah, I've noticed summertime. I mean, I'm still relative new podcast. I just did 100, just got 100 episodes. So like my 100th episode. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I'm still fairly new. I've noticed this last couple of months. My numbers were down just a little bit the last couple of months. I think summertime is kind of that way.
Yeah, I think I noticed that a while ago, and I thought, right, what can I do to offset that? And so therefore, that's why I started doing like the bonus episodes in August, just to try and increase volume. But, you know, each their own. It's what, you know, it's what people can do, what they can fit in. And obviously, you know, I love interviewing, speaking with amazing women, helping to promote their stories. And my biggest issue is that I've just got such a backlog. Like, I feel awful. You know, women who I've spoken to 12 months ago, 18 months ago, I still haven't managed to get them on the podcast, because if you're only doing like one episode a week, you just can't get that many out there unless you're doing bonus episodes or two a week or, you know, stuff like that. So yeah,
and that's a lot of work to try to do two a week.
Oh man, yeah, I did it for 2 years, and then I've wound it back actually over the past couple of months. Just it was just too hard to maintain that level.
So how did you get started, and what led you into doing all these adventures?
Yeah, so how did it all start? Oh, I'm literally like, where's a good pinpoint to start? So probably I had a very normal life, graduated, moved down to London, started working in banking. And it was one of those times of my life, you know, when you're in your early 20s and you're just having a lot of fun, you're burning the candle at both ends. And I was looking at my money for the month, and I'd realized I basically spent it all. But I paid for my rent. I still had food at home. The only thing that I couldn't afford to pay for was the transport to get to work. And at that point, I was living in West Kensington, working in Knightsbridge. It's about 3 miles away. And I thought, oh, well, I could run it. It's only, you know, it's only Monday to Friday. I get paid on Friday. And that is literally how I started running. Because I couldn't afford to get the transport. So ran to and from work every day that week. It was during the summer. So it was actually this really beautiful, pleasant experience. And, you know, I left my house at sort of, you know, 6:30, got, by the time I got there, it was 7, had a quick shower because we had all the facilities at work, which was great. And I was at my desk by 7:30 and had already done, you know, like an hour and a half work before anybody else had arrived. And so it was just so productive and getting so much work done. So it was ticking a lot of boxes. And then you'd finish for the day, you'd run home, and you'd de-stress. And I just carried on doing it. And then I found more of my friends had signed up for the London Marathon, and all the conversation was around like running. And I was thinking, well, I've got to get involved in this. And like, everyone's talking about running marathon. I need to run a marathon. And I signed up to run the London Marathon. And because back at that point in my life, I was almost like quite extreme. And so I didn't just want to run one marathon. I was like, well, why don't I just run a marathon every year until I'm 30? And that's what I ended up doing. And you know, I was still working in like my corporate career at this point. And then I left the corporate world when I was 32, and I set up Tough Girl Challenges. And when I was setting up Tough Girl Challenges, its whole mission was to increase the amount of female role models in the media while increasing, yeah, let me just say that again. So it's all about increasing the amount of female role models in the media, especially in the world of like physical challenges and adventure. And I wanted to launch Tough Girl Challenges with a bit of a bang, because, you know, if I'm out there sort of talking the talk, I need to walk the walk as such. And the Marathon des Sables is this iconic race that so many people have heard of. You know, it was named by the Discovery Channel many years ago now. It's like the world's toughest foot race. I do think that has changed. I'll just put that out there. I think there are far tougher races now than the Marathon des Sables. But back then when I did it in 2016, it was, you know, it was very well heard of. People knew it was this 250 kilometer, 156 miles running through the desert, carrying everything you need on your back. And that was the challenge that scared me and excited me. And I signed up for it, ended up running it, you know, having an absolute incredible time. But that was sort of like a brief sort of journey into how it began. And then after I finished Marathon des Sables, it was like, right, what can I do next? Because I'd realized I'd trained for like 18 months to have this like 7-day experience, and then it was over, and it was over too quickly for me. And so I thought, well, what's the next challenge that I can do? I want the challenge to be longer, but still as challenging. And I'd heard about the Appalachian Trail, and I thought, ooh, well, you know, that's only doing, I thought, well, if I do the 2,200 miles in 100 days, that's averaging 22 miles per day. That sounds pretty doable. I think I was quite naive about how challenging it would actually end up being. And yeah, so that was my next big challenge, through hiking the Appalachian Trail, which I did in 2017. I did end up injuring myself on my left knee, so I couldn't actually straighten my leg for quite a while. So because I couldn't walk, run, or do anything that I'd done previously, I thought, well, what about cycling? I can still cycle. And that's how I ended up flying over to Vancouver in 2018, buying a secondhand bike and cycling down the Pacific Coast Highway, because that was basically my only option until I finally sort of sorted out my my left hand side, which was full of injuries. And then I got back into hiking again and ended up doing the Camino Portuguese, the Lycian Way, walking the Overland Track in Tasmania. And recently I've just finished doing the Wales Coastal Path in the UK, 870 miles in 50 days. So yeah, there's quite a few different adventures and challenges in there, and obviously happy to expand on any of those bits and bobs.
Yeah, well, for people who don't know about the Marathon des Sables, that is in the Sahara Desert. Is that right?
Correct. Over in Morocco in the Sahara Desert, it's normally held every year in sort of April time, although last year they held it in October and it didn't have good results. There was a very high percentage dropout rate just because of the heat was just far too...
It was much hotter in October.
Yeah, much, much hotter. And I don't think they were really prepared or a lot of people weren't really prepared for that. So, but I was very fortunate when I did the Marathon des Sables, I was able to heat train over in Australia. So in Australia was having like a heat wave, it was 40 degrees and I'd be like, well, this is perfect. I can go outside. Everyone obviously thought I was a little bit crazy because I'd be running with my backpack on with the two water bottles at the front, baseball cap, and just going out and either doing time on feet or doing distance training, or whether it was hills or sprints or something. But I'd be out there for 4 or 5 hours most days running, and then spending the rest of the time recovering. So I love the heat. That's one of the reasons I picked the Marathon des Sables, is sunshine, heat, that is my jam. I am the cold, the wet, the rain, that's a big no from me. But yeah, sunshine, warmth and heat, that's what I love.
And you wrote a book about that, and I liked your book that it was it talked about you talked about kind of how you got into running, some of the health challenges that you'd had during that. But then at the end is like, for somebody who wanted to do it, here's, kind of a, it was not only a memoir about your experience, but a kind of how to manual if somebody wanted to do it. And so
I thought, definitely. No, that's almost what I wanted, because that was the book that I wanted to read before I did Marathon des Sables. I wanted somebody just to lay it out, because there is a lot of information out there. There's a lot of interviews on podcasts, and there's a lot of blog posts, and there is a lot of information. But I just want it all in one place, especially from like a female perspective as well, being a woman doing the race. Because out of the, I think there's generally around 1,100 competitors. Generally, there's maybe only 200 women who do the race, and so it is about sharing that female specific knowledge. But yeah, I mean, because I was meant to do the Marathon des Sables in 2015, but just messed it up so badly in terms of my training. I just did everything that you could do wrong, I did wrong. I had the mindset, it's the more miles, the better, the more training, the better, the harder I push myself, the better. And it was completely wrong. I physically destroyed myself. I lost a ton of weight. My hair was falling out. My left eye was disintegrating. I had horrendous acne on my face. I was struggling to get out of bed. It was really, really not a good time for me. And one of the things you do for Marathon des Sables as well, is you have to get like an ECG done. You have to get a doctor's note. And mentally, I was still thinking that this was at December time. And I was thinking, I'm still going to be running this race in April. And the doctor was like, you cannot do this. And I was like, of course I can do this. And it's like, actually, no, physically, you can barely make it out of bed. This is not going to be good for you. So I had to postpone it for a year, took another, 6 months to get my health back, and then started training this time with a coach, did it in two separate blocks. So the first block was around the building the strength and the conditioning, getting, building up the core muscles, the strength, all of that, really solid block to get strong. And then the final sort of 3-4 months was the running, was the endurance. And, for me, many people go into a goal with the Marathon des Sables. Is it a goal to complete it? Is it to compete? And for me, it was just getting to the start line fit, strong and healthy. And that's what I did. And I ended up having a fantastic time out there. I think I came like 440th out of like 1,200 people. But I still remember like the long stage, just running 52 miles in a day. And I'd never run past 30 miles before. And when you're mentally, when you're going to places that your body has never been, it becomes absolutely fascinating, because you literally just don't know what's going to happen. And I think 32, 33 miles in, I started feeling incredible. The endorphins were just flying. And I remember being stood at the top of these sand dunes, looking down, thinking, this is incredible. Like just the views overlooking the desert and seeing these undulating sand dunes. And I tightened the straps on my backpack and I took a sip of my water, had my salt tablet and started running down these sand dunes, just flying. Like, you know, when you're in flow and you feel everything is working, everything is in sync. And in my mind, I was thinking, this is incredible. Like, this is how the next 20 miles are going to go. It's going to be awesome. And then about sort of like five or six miles later, it was like just hitting a wall, obviously not like a literal wall in the desert, but just like this, where my body was just like, no, my mind was like, no. And it was darker now. It was colder. It was, you know, it was a struggle trying to see the lights of the direction of where you're going. And that's when it became this full on mental battle, just me battling me, like, you know, you've got to keep going. You just got to keep moving, get through the checkpoints. And that was like a tough few miles, but you always have these like low moments in ultra races. You know, they're going to come, and it's how do you get yourself out of that dark hole, that dark pit that you're in, and coming out of it. And I mean, actually one of the worst things on Marathon des Sables is you can see so far ahead. So I could see the finish. I could see the camp in the distance, and it looked so close. It looked like you could touch it. But the problem was, it was probably like another 6 or 7 like hours away. And so that mentally, again, that's like another hit you've got to take, or something else that you've just got to deal with. But I still remember I crossed the finish line at 1:56 in the morning of the 14th of April. And there's this wonderful photo of me like blowing a kiss at the camera. And I got given my sweet tea at the end, and I was just chatting with the support staff there. And I felt amazing and incredible. But by the time I collected my water, and I was thinking to myself, do you know what? I could carry on going. I think I could do another 50 miles. Collected my water. By the time I'd walked from, you know, the finish line to my tent, it was like my body was like, oh, we stop now. And like the pain receptors release, and like the adrenaline had stopped. And then my body just almost went into shutdown. And that's, oh my goodness, just lying there where you can't lie on your back because your back hurts. You can't lie on your front, your side, your feet are throbbing, your head is throbbing, your hands are throbbing, your whole body is just in pain. And you know, the only thing that you can do is go to sleep, because there's nothing else you can do to help yourself. And, you know, I was very fortunate. So I got in at just before 2 in the morning. There were still people coming in 10, 12, 14 hours later. So I slept for say 8 hours, woke up in the morning, and then I was there to cheer on the other competitors who'd been out there all of that time, like so much longer than me. And to be honest, that's hard as well. You know, it's hard doing it relatively fast, but it's also hard doing it a little bit slower as well. So yeah, the incredible experience, one I have fond memories of.
Well, you know, that's, you know, that's typical in an ultra marathon. You get those times when you feel like you can go forever, and then you know, when you have when that's followed by the down, you've got the ups and downs. And so you know, that feeling where you feel like you go forever, you know, your body's clicking and everything, that you get this mental high, like, you know, like you said, I'm going to feel this way the rest of the time. And then you find out you won't, and that you feel like, because you can't hardly go on. How did you deal with that kind of mental, you know, the mental part of it? Because it is a mental, I mean, your body is feeling, you can't really trust how your body's feeling, you know, in either case.
Yeah, I had I'd actually done a lot of work even before the Marathon des Sables on the mental side of things, from, you know, the power of visualization, thinking, imagining myself crossing that finish line and physically having that medal put around my neck. I created my own certificate of achievement, which I'd stuck on the mirror, which I could look at every morning. But a couple of other things that I found really, really useful were things like gratitude, and actually looking back and realizing that actually, do you know, this is a choice that I have made. I decided a long time ago to pay, you know, back then I think I paid like £3,500 to enter this race. I have trained for this. You know, this is a choice that I've made. And actually, do I want to choose to focus on the negative, the darkness, being miserable and how much my feet hurt and, you know, everything else? Or do I want to focus on the beauty of the scenery, the fact that I'm out here under the stars, that I am surrounded by incredibly motivated, inspiring people? Again, you know, that's a choice. So it was definitely a choice about my attitude that I had, being positive. Like just making that 100% a choice. And then there was also like practical things like, having mantras, listening to music. I would also break things down, you know, when you've got a watch on, looking at the time. It's like, okay, let's break it down. Right. Next 4 minutes. Where are we going to go? What are we going to do? Sometimes I even remember saying this to myself because I was slowing down so much when I was having to walk sections that my body almost wasn't moving forward. And so I was having to say to myself over again, like, step, 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 like keep stepping forward, keep moving your feet, just keep the momentum going. So there was time, there was mental arithmetic. So so if I've got 4 minutes left out of an hour, that would leave me 56 minutes, 56 minutes divided by, and by the time, you sort of write this all out, it would, you'd have to start again. Sometimes I'd ask myself ridiculous questions. I'd be like, right, Sarah, you just won the lottery. You've got £5 million or $5 million. How would you spend it? And my mind would go off into this world of like how I'd spend all this money and what I'd spend it on. And then sometimes it would just be like routines, like checking in with myself. Okay, let's just sort of work through the body. How are the feet feeling? Okay, how are the knees doing? Am I thirsty? Am I hungry? When was the last time I ate? Have I had a salt tablet? Do I need a sip of water? Do I need some electrolytes? Okay, let's have a little sip of water. That's great. Sometimes as well, just breathing, like taking some really good breaths really, really helped me. So I think there's a massive combination of different sort of mental strategies and mental tips and tricks that you can use. And I think one of the other things that actually really helped me as well was actually in terms of my preparation and my training, I had like almost like a spreadsheet that you could tick off, and I could see how many miles I'd run, how many strength and conditioning sessions I'd done. So I knew I had done the work. I knew that I was fit. I knew that I was strong. And so it was just a case of actually just getting out there and doing it. And I think when you're training as well, you can end up having these really tough training sessions that you don't want to do, that you're tired and da da da. And then when you push through those training sessions, I don't know, it's like another brick to help build that resilience up. And so I found that all of those things combined together really, really helped me. And it made my experience incredibly enjoyable. And even accepting, it's okay to have these dark moments and these dark times, they're going to happen. And let's just accept it. And then let's just go through it. Let's see where it takes us and see how we get out of it. And if we're struggling to get out of it, that's okay too. Like it will pass. All these things will pass. So quite a different mixture there. So.
Yeah, that is, and it's great. I mean, you listed off a lot, and some people, the mental strategies are, you just use like one, and you had like a whole list of, if one wasn't working, you can go to another. I thought that's great. And you said you practiced before, the mental side.
Oh, definitely. And actually, there's a great tip, which actually I think anyone can do. It's, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called like the what if. It's creating this scenario. It's very simple. Get a piece of paper, and on the left-hand side, what you do is you write down all the what if scenarios. What if I run out of water? What if my shoelace breaks? What if I... this is ultra running. What if I have an accident in my pants? What if I run out? But all of the fears that you could have, and this is also, say you're doing it, you want to involve your family, or you've got parents or friends who are a little bit concerned, ask them the questions. What are their fears? What are their concerns? Write them down on the left-hand side of the piece of paper. And then when you're at home in this really nice, safe, comfortable environment, you start going through the answers. So, so what if I run out of water? Okay, well, I know how long I can run without having to carry water. I know that I will drink when I get to a checkpoint. I know that I will get my full liters, etc. I know that there are, if the situation does get really desperate, I know that I have like a spot tracker that I can press. I know that there will be other people on the field. Maybe other people can lend me some more. There's all these different options. What if my shoelace breaks? Well, it's highly unrealistic that it would happen, but if it does happen, do I need to carry a spare? How much would that weigh? All of these things. So you can actually go through them in your head. So what you're doing there is mentally, you're running through the scenario. So if something like that does happen when you're out on your ultra challenge or ultra adventure, you've already been through it in your head. So it's not your brain isn't having to figure it out for the first time because you've already thought these things through, and your brain will be like, oh yeah, we thought about this. You can just do this. Don't worry about it. It'll be absolutely fine. Yeah. Okay. You haven't got any food for a while. It's okay. You know, you can keep going for the next 4 hours without food. You'll be fine. Same with water. Look, you can keep going for the next 3 hours. It's in the middle of the night. It's not that hot. Look, you could stop. You can get water from XYZ. So that's a really powerful one as well. Yeah, the what if technique.
I like that. And I have talked to people about making a list beforehand. What will be the thing that caused you to DNF? Thinking as like typically a lot of ultra runners, the 100 miles is kind of the benchmark. Like, let's go out and do a 100 miler. And, there's a lot of things that can make your race go wrong, even if you've done everything right. And so, I kind of counsel people, to get away from your mind convincing you that it's time to quit, of making a list of here's the things, here's the criteria that I'm going to use, basically, if it's going to threaten my life, threaten my long-term health, those are things to DNF, but it helps having that kind of set beforehand so that you don't get to, mile 75 and your body's, you've got an ache and your mind's telling you that you're going to die, and you're not. And so, that's. It's similar to what you said, the what ifs. I like that. I like the what if, because there are so many other things that can go wrong in an ultramarathon. And, when you're out in the desert, when you're doing a multi-day race, there's even more things that can go wrong. Mm-hmm. And having that plan beforehand, I think that's a good strategy.
It's almost like, what can you control? Because I think if you things like the weather, the temperature, things like that, you have got no control over it. So you almost can't waste energy on worrying about that. You can plan for it, you can prepare for it, but there's only so much you can do before actually, it doesn't affect me anymore, because it is hot. We knew it was going to be hot. You're running in the desert, but these extremes of temperature, like you prepared for it in advance. You've got your cap, you've got your sunscreen, you drink your water, you're doing everything that you possibly can. But otherwise, you can't stop the sun from shining. So you've got to focus on what you can actually control. And sometimes like that can always be quite powerful as well, when you can just sort of let it go, let the other things go, and just like let it wash over you and like think, no, I can't control that. Let's not focus on it.
Yeah. So one of the things that I had thought about, kind of going back, what was the thing that you were in a corporate job and then you decided all of a sudden, this is not the way I want my life to go. And you started these adventures. So what was kind of the thought process that made you kind of take a big shift in your life?
Yeah. I think I'd always realized that there was something missing from my life. Well, I wasn't 100% sure what it was. And from the outside, people looking in would be like, oh, Sarah, you've got a great job. You work for this amazing company. You get the status from that, the ego's massage, nice pay packet, living sort of the London lifestyle, very nice holidays. And I could never work out, like, why was I not happy? Like, people who would be in my situation should be happy. And I'm a very positive person, and sometimes I can force myself to be too positive. And, like Sunday night blues, the Sunday before, having to go into work on Monday, when you start stressing at 10 in the morning, you're waking up at the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in shock thinking, oh my God, has that been done? When you're addicted to your BlackBerry and replying, and you realize that actually your happiness isn't changing. Your environment's not going to change. The people you work with isn't going to change. So you've got to be the one who's got to do something about it. And, look, I was in a very fortunate position. I didn't have any debt. I didn't have any dependents. I did have flexibility. I had savings. And I just thought, I cannot continue to live my life like this. Like, I am gray. I'm tired. I'm ill. I'm run down. And I can't do another 20 years of this, like sat behind a desk looking at computer screens. Like, this cannot be my life, like, at all. And I think after I'd sort of realized that, I made the decision, left my job. I I had the savings, so I knew I'd be able to support myself the next 18 months or so. And I actually, after leaving, after quitting, you think, oh, that must have felt like euphoric and amazing. I actually felt like a massive failure because I thought, oh, you know, I can't hack it. I can't make it in the world of banking, even though it was like toxic. And I spent the rest of the time trying to figure out, hold on, what do I want to do? Because sometimes I felt like I'd been on this like nonstop wheel. Like you get your A levels, you go to university, you graduate, you get on a graduate scheme, you get on this career ladder, you get promotions and experiences, and you start progressing, and you earn more money, and you get bonuses, and so on and so forth. And I really needed to have a think about who I was, what did I enjoy, what were my passions, what were my interests, and actually, what did I want my life to look like, you know? And I spent some time over in South America, and I did loads of journaling and loads of writing. So in South America, one of the ways that you travel is on these buses. And I just sit there, you know, nothing, the scenery was all the same for, you know, for hours and hours at a time. And I just asked myself these really simple questions, like, what do I like? What do I dislike? What would I like my life to look like? And I've still got what I've written. And I wrote this blog post back in, I think it was March 2014, where I sort of described tough girl challenges. You know, I wanted to create this business of combining my passions, you know, venture, travel, challenge, but also my other passion of motivating, inspiring women and girls. And I started blogging initially, and no one read my blog. not even my mum, because she's not even that technical. And didn't really have the traction that I wanted. But I knew that I wanted to be able to travel, go on these adventures, but also live and work anywhere in the world. And technology was changing at that point, you know, because when I was growing up, YouTube wasn't around, you know, social media was owned, like after I'd left university, that's when social media started coming out. So these options now where you can host a podcast and you can film yourself and you can do the editing and, you know, be on YouTube wasn't an option, and podcasting was still really sort of in its infancy when I started out. But I had a really good friend who said, look, why didn't you interview these incredible women and share their stories? And starting the podcast changed my life, like getting these stories out there, interviewing these incredible women. And over time, you know, I've done these different challenges. Like, you know, I moved back home with my parents. I was meant to be living with them for, you know, for like 6 weeks. It's like 6 years later, I'm still living with them. And I've just massively changed my life. So now I don't have the financial security that I used to have, but I have my mental health, I have my health, and I have freedom of choice of what I do, how I spend my time. And in terms of happiness and well-being, oh my goodness, I feel like one of the most successful people ever, because I genuinely love what I do and how I spend my time. It is incredible. It's not to say that I don't work hard, because some people don't really understand that actually you can still spend 15, 16 hours a day on your laptop, you know, doing editing and processing and doing the behind the scenes stuff. But I really love and enjoy what I'm doing now. So yeah, it's been quite drastic, but it's taken a massive, you know, it's taken 6-7 years to get to this point where, you know, I'm making money, I'm working with brands, I'm working with sponsors. It definitely has not happened overnight. It's been a long, hard slog, but I've now got to the point where the Tough Girl podcast, you know, it's won 3 awards. It's had over 2 million downloads. It's in the top 15% of podcasts globally. There's over 500 episodes on the back catalog. You know, personally, the fact that I can go out and take on, you know, through hiking the Appalachian Trail, cycling the Pacific Coast Highway, you know, spending time, I've got family in Australia, spending time with them over there, is one of the best things I've ever done. So, yeah.
I made the decision a while back that I wouldn't ask companies to sponsor this show. It's not that I didn't believe in their products. There are a lot of good products out there that I would love to promote. I just wanted to have the freedom to put the show together in a way that felt right to me. And sponsors often want to dictate where their advertisements go in the show. At the same time, you know, I wanted to give you who listen and who like the show to support this show if you chose to. So I decided to start putting this short break in the middle to talk about a couple of offers that I've got. At the ultramindsetpodcast.run, you can find a link to Amazon. It's an affiliate link. That means if you click on the link and then make a purchase, I get a small percentage
from certain items. It doesn't cost you any extra. And you may have used affiliate links before when you purchase something from Amazon. If you've ever seen one of those top 10 best products review things, that they're all over, and I know I check those out when I want to buy products. Those links to the products, because I mean they give you the review, tell you, and if you want to buy it right then, you click on the link. The people who wrote that and put that top 10 list together will get a small percentage because it's an affiliate link. Now, I'm not pushing any products. I'm not going to be doing top 10 reviews here on the show. I only set this up just to ask that you would consider grabbing that link from the ultramindsetpodcast.run and use it when you shop Amazon. That's it. It will help me keep the lights on here at the podcast. I truly appreciate your support, and thanks a lot for listening. And you had done this, you say you did this to kind of inspire women to inspire women to see possibilities that they might not see. That's something as I've gotten older, and you know, my wife and I've had conversations, and you know, she's talked about oftentimes she'll mention some of the things that she has experienced even now not being taken seriously, even by other women. I mean, because we've run a business together for 30 years, and it's in the services industry, is somewhat in the construction, and so you know she gets ignored when she, you know, the men who are painters dressed as painters will get attention before she does, because she doesn't wear paint clothes. I mean, she just wears regular clothes, and so. She oftentimes doesn't get taken seriously, although you know, she knows as much about paint as probably the person behind the counter. And so what is you've been doing this for 6 years. What are you seeing as the opportunities for women and the challenges that women still face?
Oh God. I'm literally like, where do I even start? I'll try and keep it quite focused. Cause I actually ended up going to do a master's in women and gender studies in 2017, 2018 to try and learn more about this topic. And I mean, one of the reasons I actually started the podcast is when I was going out to schools to give motivational talks to young girls to talk about adventure and challenge. And I'd talk to them about their goals and their ambitions and what they wanted to do. And so many girls were saying to me that they wanted to grow up to be a WAG. Now, in the UK, what that means is it's basically the wife and girlfriend of a footballer or a celebrity. So it would be like, so in America, it would be like, I want to marry like an NFL player. Mm-hmm. I want to marry like an NBA star or something. And for me, it was just, and by the way, I'm a feminist. Like, look, if that's your goal, go for it. That's awesome. But why aren't you wanting to grow up to play football for your country? Why aren't you wanting to grow up to be a sports star, to be an athlete, to be somebody, not just to be the partner of somebody and support them with what they're doing? And even now, like I would say, like if you look at the papers, go to your papers, your newspapers, go to the back, and it's like it's men's sports. It's just men's sports which are shown. They are the ones who get the sponsorship. They are the ones who get the visibility. And there was research done in the UK, and there was some, you know, horrendous stats that women get something like 0.4% of the media sponsorship. There are exceptions in that. So tennis is one. When the Olympics are on, women do get more exposure. But, you know, you would have even seen like during the Rio Olympics, you know, like a woman would have won a gold medal, and they're telling literally the newspaper line is the husband's name, wife of so-and-so has won, not even mentioning her name. And so just there's so many instances of that. And I think back to when I was in, you know, in my early 30s and thinking about, you know, what I wanted to do, I didn't know that women went on these adventures and challenges. Like I didn't know that women had like cycled. I mean, I sort of knew that women must have done it, but I'd never read about it. I'd never seen it. I'd never heard their stories. And I thought, hold on, I'm you know, a pretty educated woman here. I've got access to everything. Why am I not seeing these women doing these challenging adventures? And I thought, well, if I'm struggling to find it, what hope do the next generation of girls and boys, because boys need to see women doing these challenges and adventures as well. It's not just role models for girls, it's role models for boys. And I just don't want to sit and complain about something. Like complaining about something isn't going to change it. You've actually got to take action to make changes. And so for me, what could I do? and I love talking. And with the podcast, that's definitely helped to increase the amount of role models in the media. So now, you know, young women and girls growing up, they can be like, okay, well, I want to run Marathon des Sables. Great. I've spoken to 20 women who run Marathon des Sables, all ages, all backgrounds, all shapes, all sizes, who've done it. You're interested in cycling. Brilliant. What type of cycling is it? Do you want to, I've spoken to the youngest woman to cycle around the world. I've spoken to the fastest woman to cycle around the world. I've spoken to the first woman to cycle around the world. I've spoken to the two women who broke the world record cycling on a tandem bike. They are sharing their stories, and it's not just about their stories. They're also sharing the obstacles that they face, the barriers that they've overcome, and how they've done it. So for many, it's like, well, what are the fears that you have to overcome? But also the practicalities. Well, how did you pay for it? And especially for women, when you get into your 30s and 40s, and beyond, whether you're married or you've got childcare, and if you're older, maybe it's looking after elderly parents, or you're working a full-time job, like, how do you balance these things out? Like, how can you make exercise and fitness an important part of your life? And so it is about, so there is power in seeing women doing these challenges, you know, seeing their photos up there, and, you know, seeing it is believing it. But then it's also, for me, it's that next step. Like, so you can see someone doing it, and that is fantastic. But then how can ordinary women do it? And that's where I think the power of the podcast comes in. So I'd love to give like a general summation that I think things are improving. I think they are, but I counteract that with, because I now sort of, I'm very involved in the world of women in adventure and women in challenges, and my social media feeds are filled with women doing adventures and challenges. I do think it is the new normal, but I know actually that unless you've got an amazing feed like mine, you're probably not going to see or hear these women. And it comes down to word of mouth. Like, you know, women are not going to get the mainstream media exposure. And so it comes down to women saying to other women, oh, hey, have you listened to X on the Tough Girl podcast? She's just shared more about her adventure and challenge. And then that is how it spreads. It's almost this underground swell. Then what happens is women listen to, you know, the Tough Girl podcast, for example, and hear these stories and think, well, hold on, if she's done that, maybe I can sign up for that 5K race. Maybe I can sign up for a half marathon. Why don't I go for a marathon? And when a woman does that, she then impacts her friends, her peers, her work colleagues, her family. And they all start thinking, oh, well, Sharon or Susie, she's just like me. Why don't I could do this then? And then they go out and do it. And, you know, it's just that positive ripple spreading out. And, you know, and that does take time. You do have to be patient, but I'm beyond being patient. Like, I just want to just continue sharing the story, so that, you know, if anyone's ever said to me, so, oh, women don't climb mountains, like, yes, they do. Here's 200 episodes of Women Don't Go to the South Pole. Yes, they do. Here's the youngest, the oldest. Here's teams of women who's done it. Here's the first woman of color who's done it. Here's the first Black woman who's done it. Those stories are out there. And I'm just, you know, I'm just happy that I can facilitate that and help to get those stories out there.
So as men, I mean, there are men who will be listening to this as well. How can men help women to break through those barriers?
Yeah. To be honest, I have a lot of male listeners and a lot of male supporters. And what I would say is, to be honest, it could just be practical stuff. You know, if you're married to a woman, are you helping with the emotional load? Are you helping with the chores, like the household chores? Women end up doing more than men generally. Is it sitting down? Is it communicating? Is it like, how can I support you when you go after your goal? What do you need from me? Is it more support? Like, I'm trying to think. I don't even know. There's so many different things. To be honest, it's things like, if it's a running race, say you're at a race and you notice that there's a first, second and third position and the men are being paid 500, 250, 50, and you notice that there's no prizes for women, call it out. If you notice that the women's first prize is only $100, call it out. If you notice that they don't have a policy for pregnant women to postpone their race by a year, call it out. Like, especially if you're in positions of power and influence, sometimes you have to step back and let women take over, I'm afraid, and support from the sidelines. There's lots of things that men can do. It just depends, you know, A, where you are and what resources that you have available. But yes, standing up, shouting about it, sharing women who do amazing things, promoting them on social media, watching the sports, like commenting on it in a positive way. But also the big one is calling out other men. If you see other men who are saying, well, who's interested in women's soccer? Who's interested in women's that? You know, stand up and say, I am. And no, we don't say that anymore. And no, we don't catcall women. And, you know, all of those things. Like, men can do a huge amount. It can't just be women doing this and you know, fighting the good fight as such.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Since I've become part of the ultramarathon community, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the, you know, the women still aren't, you know, there's not they're trying to make it so that it's more women have availability, because you know, a lot of times the spots will fill up and women haven't had a chance. You know, they're underrepresented as far as numbers, but as far as the determination and the grit to go out and, I mean, women I run with are tough women. I mean, and these aren't professionals. I mean, they're just, you know, we're all out there on the trail. We're all sweating. We're all, you know, dealing with spider webs and bugs and, you know, or the freezing cold. And, you know, the women, hold their own with the men. And, so I, in my circle, I don't see the kind of, but I know in, you know, when you get into higher levels and in other areas that women do face those kinds of barriers and discriminations that, that men, we don't, just because we're men, we don't see it. And it's oftentimes we're not aware of it. And the women are tough enough that they have just not said anything and just kind of press on and deal with whatever life has thrown them. And so,
Maybe that's when like things like quotas come in and say, actually, do you know what? We want to make sure that there's 30, 40% of these places are for women or women who identify as women only. And also believing women when they say, actually, because one of the other big issues that has started to come up now is especially on the longer races with if women are running solo by themselves through sort of remoter areas, where should there be more checkpoints there? Should women have, like, do they need to have escorts? Is this things that, you know, that should be discussed? Because I know women who haven't felt safe on some ultra races, running through certain areas, especially overnight, and therefore they stop. And they physically, they could carry on, but they know that their safety is not being looked after. It's not being by the race facilitators. They just haven't taken things like that into consideration. You know, where's the race being held, like, and stuff like that. So there's lots of, and I'm sure women are talking about it. It's almost like just hearing the women's voices and stories and thinking, okay, well, what can we do? How can we make this better? What changes can I make? What changes can I implement to make a difference here? Yeah. But if I would just say, like, if you see it, call it out. If you see something which is unjust and unfair, and you know it's unfair, even though that's all the way that it's always been done, it's sometimes much more powerful when it comes from a white man saying, actually, it's not fair that there isn't equality in the fact that there's three places, or why aren't there more female runners? Call it out. If you see it, say something.
Yeah, and I know that there are some races that I've seen recently that they have reserved some, you know, a certain percentage for women. You know, I think that's a good step.
Definitely another step in the right direction. All these things, you know, add up, because then more women are doing it, more women are racing. There's more FKT, there's more records to be broken. There's other women who see other women doing it. It's just, you know, another positive step in the right direction.
Yeah. So what is kind of, you've got a long list, and you also climbed Kilimanjaro. I know that that you had, you'd written a book about that. So what was that like?
Oh, Kilimanjaro was awesome. So that was actually done, I did it with my sister back when I was still, like, that was part of like my gap year after I've left my job. It was challenging. It was tough. I just don't think I had really had any idea what it was going to be like. And I got asked so many questions afterwards. And I thought, well, let's just write a little ebook about it and, you know, share my story. And I like you know, I like writing, I like sharing, I like helping people, because, you know, especially some people, they like reading things so they can highlight and underline and, you know, to remind themselves. But, you know, Kili was fantastic. But again, it, like the summit push, you know, that's the hardest day when you're on the mountain. It's again, it, yes, it is physical, but it is that mental challenge. And I think one of the hardest things on Kili is when you start the summit push, you're in this sort of single file straight line and you're wearing a head torch, and the head torch illuminates like about a meter in front of you. And then the rest is pitch black and dark, and you can't see anything else. And all you can see is like the back of the person in front of you's footsteps as they're walking. And that psychologically, it's a real mind bender, because just that little bit of light, and that's all you can see for hours and hours. And that's when your mind starts to wander. What am I doing here? Why are you on the mountain? God, it's a bit cold, isn't it? Oh, you've got a bit of a headache. Oh, have you drunk water? Are you sure you want to be doing this? It's a bit tough, isn't it? You know, because your body's trying to protect itself and doesn't want you to take these sort of risks, even though it's, you know, it's not that risky. And but then it's all worth it, because once you get to Gilman's Point, so you still maybe got like about 500 meters to go at that point, but you get to that point, the sun is starting to come up, you can see the curvature of the earth, you're above the cloud layer, the sky is just incredible and wonderful. But the 500 meters you've got to walk isn't going to be a quick one, because obviously everything at altitude is so much harder and you're so much slower, and it just come down to this perseverance. But again, it was another incredible opportunity and incredible challenge to do it. I did it with a group of people, 8-9 people, you know, it was my sister and a few other people who we didn't know, just sort of met up there on the climb. And it's just an amazing experience. And especially with Kilimanjaro, the great thing about it is it's a freestanding mountain, so you don't need technical climbing experience to do it. It is walkable. And so it is open for a whole range of people to do it, you know, all ages, sizes, abilities. And it's not always the youngest and the fittest who are going to get to the top, because sometimes people can burn themselves out. It's more about people who are consistent and steady and just keep showing up and just keep putting that one foot in front of the other. Again, an incredible opportunity. I'd recommend it to anyone to go and climb it. I've recently been looking at so Aconcagua in South America, trying to figure out, you know, would I be able to go and climb that mountain? And so I actually visited, so in London, they have something called the Altitude Center, which is a place where you can go where they can test you to see how your body will react at altitude. And they write this sort of report on you to see how your body responds to lack of oxygen. That was a really, really fascinating process to go through. So I'm just waiting for my report to come back from that, but that'll be quite an interesting read, just to get an understanding before I fully make the decision. Like, do I have the time? Do I have the finances? Am I ready to make that bigger commitment to jump into the training that's going to be needed to make sure that I'm as fit, strong and healthy as possible to take on a challenge like that? So that's what I'm umming and ahhing at the moment, but I would love to do a few more mountains at some point.
So which mountain was it you were looking at?
So it's called Aconcagua. It's like the highest mountain in South America. And because of the climbing seasons and how it works, generally, if you climb Aconcagua, it's January, February, March. And the Everest season is March, April, May. When you climb Aconcagua, you will generally be the highest. You will be the highest person in the world when you stand on it at that point in time, which is pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah. So is that there's. I talked to a couple of guys who are mountain. They call themselves the High Point. The Seven Summits. Yeah.
Summits. Yeah.
And I'm not a mountain climber. Haven't researched.
Yeah, it's one of the seven summits. So the Seven Summits is the highest mountain on every continent. So Kilimanjaro is the highest mountain in Africa. Everest, highest mountain, Asia. And you've got Denali in North America. Aconcagua, South America. Elbrus for Europe. Stroke Russia. And then there's two different schools of thought on it. One of them includes a mountain called in Australia called Mount Kosciuszko, which I have actually climbed as well, but it's not really a mountain. It's more like I'm not even sure of the height, but like you climb it and you're just like, this can't be one of the seven summits because it's so little. But then you've got like Carson's Pyramids, which is obviously a little bit more challenging, and then you've got Mount Vincent in Antarctica. But those ones, because of their locations, are, you know, extremely expensive expeditions to take on. So
The Bargo brothers, I talked to them on my podcast, and they call themselves the High Pointers, and they're going to the high point of every state in the United States.
Nice.
And so I saw on their social media, they recently did Kansas, which is the high point is flat.
Tick that off the list. That was an easy one.
But it's not easy to get to. I mean, I live in Kansas is my state, is my home state. And so I live on the east side, and the high point is on the far west side, but it's just wide open country. And I mean, you would never know it. You would never know it unless there was a sign there saying this is the highest
point. This is the highest point. You need your GPS there.
Yes, gosh, you do. And it's in a farmer's field. I mean, it's not even public land. So there's just a little.
The farmer should set up a little, a little sign, like, just come and get your photo taken at the highest point in Kansas.
There is. Right? There's a little sign there. It's kind of a fenced off area so you drive gravel roads to get there. And
that's awesome. What a challenge. Fun challenge.
Yeah. And so, but they've also, done Denali and in Colorado. I mean, they're doing it in every
Whitney.
State. It's more of a, they're filming it and doing like a documentary and talking about the state, talking about the area and people. They've got a good story about kind of their adventures, but they've done the seven, they're working on the seven peaks. I don't know if they've completed it, but they've done them in several continents as well. So
very cool. Very cool.
So you have, what is kind of ahead for you? I mean, you said you're thinking about doing some mountains. Do you have other challenges that you're going to be taking?
Yes. One over in America, actually, which you've probably heard of, which is the Pacific Crest Trail.
Yes. I know a guy who has, who's hiked that.
Yeah. So I'm looking at that, to be honest, quite seriously for next year. I wouldn't be able to do it Nobo, which is walking from Mexico up to Canada. I'd have to do it just for the various commitments. I'd only be able to start after the 10th of July. And so therefore, it'd have to be a Sobo, so southbound hike. So starting up in Canada and then heading down to San Diego. So I vlog my challenges. I film my challenges when I'm out and about because I want to show people like what it's like to, to be out there on adventures, on challenges. So it's not always sunsets and beautiful pictures. I do share a lot of beautiful views, but I show them the blisters when I'm being sick, when other things are happening, when like there's rock falls or there's fallen trees or there's horrendous weather, and I really enjoy the vlogging side of things. I share the videos on YouTube. So for example, you could watch my Appalachian Trail vlogs, like what it was like day to day. There's also a very short 6-minute film of it and like my cycle ride and everything. So I'm actually debating how long I want to do it in, because I would, and this isn't me being arrogant, it's just that I would finish the trail. Like there is no doubt in my mind that I could finish the trail in 5 months, 6 months, whatever. There's no issue. I'm just thinking about how much I want to push myself and challenge myself. So I did the Appalachian Trail in 100 days and it really did break me towards the end. But I also feel as though now I'm a little bit older. I think I've learned so much from that experience in terms of how I hike. My gear is also a lot better. So when I first started out, I didn't have the best gear. And it's not always about the gear, but when you're trying to go fast, you need to be light, and the lighter gear is more expensive. I've now upgraded pretty much all of my gear. So it's, it is very, very light, good quality, high-end gear. I'm just literally researching at the moment, like, do I want to do 2,600 miles in 100 days and averaging like 26 miles a day, but really because of the added miles, it'll be more like 30 miles a day. And loads of people I have read said that the Pacific Crest Trail is a lot easier walk than the Appalachian Trail. And so if you were doing, say, 20, 25 miles on the Appalachian Trail, then you'd easily be able to do 25, 30 miles on the PCT. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm looking at the moment is it's how physical do I want it to be? Because I think if I'd done the Appalachian Trail in say like 110 days, maybe 115 days, I wouldn't have physically destroyed myself as much as I did, because I'd lost so much weight. I was skeletal towards the end because I couldn't consume enough calories, and I'd gone over on my left ankle numerous times, and therefore that impacted on my knee and then my hips, and so But all of that is now sorted. And it's just whether or not I could stay strong and fit and healthy enough to do a challenge like that. Or if I just be a bit more relaxed and say, okay, well, why don't you just do it in 150 days, which would be like 5 months. And then that would be a very different journey again, because it would be more relaxed, more about the people and less about the physicality of taking on a challenge like this. So the PCT would be, if I was going to do a big challenge, I could see myself doing that challenge next year. And I mentioned, like, so my brother lives in Australia. And so by getting down to San Diego, you can fly from LA to Melbourne. I think it's like it's probably still like a 16-hour flight. But, it's sort of on the way. And I could always like stop off at Hawaii or something to have some rest and recovery, which is only maybe like 11 hours from LA. So that would be an amazing challenge to take on. And I do like hiking in America, and especially I've done the Appalachian Trail, to do the Pacific Crest Trail. And then I'd be on my way to doing the Triple Crown. Have you heard of the Triple Crown?
The Triple Crown is the Continental Trail.
Continental Divide Trail in the center as well. Yeah. So that's been on the bucket list and the wish list for quite a while. But for me, it's just because of the business that I do, like I'd have to preload like loads of podcasts, which actually wouldn't be a problem now in terms of fitness, wouldn't have an issue with that. It's more just how can I vlog the challenge and share that? If I was going to do it fast in 100 days, how would that physically be possible? I don't know. So, I'm umming and ahhing at the moment. It's just the logistics. It's the logistics behind it. But I would, to get the opportunity to do something like that would be phenomenal. So that would be amazing.
Yeah, that's and the Pacific Coast Trail is one that I've kind of looked at and I was like, yeah, that sounds like that would be a lot of fun, because Brian Hoover is the guy I talked to who did that. And he had to take there was a section in the Sierra Nevada that was flooding. So he had to bypass that. He didn't actually hike the whole thing. He said, but he really did, start to finish, he did what he could. He had a great story and, talking about that, you're right. The geography out there out west is much different than what you find in Appalachia, and the challenges are different, the finding water, especially through some of the desert sections. And
But I like the desert.
I was going to say, you've been through the Sahara, so.
Yeah, I'm like, bring it on. Or if you have to do a little bit of night hiking. I mean, I think the temperatures do get quite, or can get quite extreme out there, depending on when you go. So,
But if you start up north in July and finish in 100 days, you should have great weather, all the way. That would be, that sounds like a good plan to go north, just north to south.
Yeah. Well, maybe I compromise and maybe I do it in 130 days. Cause then if I started on like July 15th or something, I could finish by like in November at some point. I don't know.
That would be a good, weather wise, that sounds like a good plan. Cause starting in the south in the spring, you're still, getting into the higher elevations in June or so, which the weather is still oftentimes cold. There's still snow in a lot of the areas. So, north to south sounds like a good plan. It sounds like a really good plan.
Fingers crossed. But who knows? You have to follow me on Instagram at Tough Girl Challenges to see if Sarah does her crew hike on the PCT.
Well, I'm sure if you don't do that, you'll come up with some other adventure. I know that it's just...
Definitely. Because sometimes as well, it's just being like open to opportunities. It's just almost being like, hey, okay, we don't need to plan everything. Let's just see what comes up, what suits, what fits in the dates, the weather, the time frame, and the other personal commitments that I have. And obviously just making sure it works with the podcast and everything else that I'm doing. So, yeah.
So tell people how can they get a hold of you if they wanted to follow you? Where's your
link? The best place to go is toughgirlchallenges.com. It's the main central hub. It's the website. There's links to the YouTube channel, to Instagram, to Facebook. I'm most active on Instagram at toughgirlchallenges, but there's also links to the podcast on there. There is over 500 episodes. And I'm not going to lie, my website is not the best in terms of finding stuff. So sometimes you might just have to spend a bit of time to root around to find the information that you're after. But I'm working on improving it. It's just sort of more of a long-term project. Yeah. But yeah, Tough Girl Challenges. challenges.
Yeah, keeping up your website is an ongoing challenge. I mean,
I'm just focusing on, you know, doing more interviews, sharing more stories, and not worrying about about how searchable it is. But that's something that I will improve on.
Yeah, well, there's always time to do that. Going out for adventure is probably a higher priority than making a website.
Pretty.
most of us can learn to navigate a website. So before I let you go, I have a tradition I've started called the bridge questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
So in your adventures, what is your most important must-have piece of gear that you rely on?
Okay, I'm going to be really honest. It's my phone. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but my phone does everything. The photos are incredible. If my GoPro doesn't work, I can film amazing video on it. I've got access to podcasts, music. If I need to use any apps, I can do it on there. I can read books on it. I can watch Netflix on it. It's my communication tool. But even, you know, so I remember having like a bad day on the Appalachian Trail. I didn't have service. I didn't have signal, but I was able to look through like some of my family photos, and that really like cheered me up, just seeing like family pictures. So I literally don't know how anyone could do anything without an iPhone at the, like out in the wild, but that's just me. So, and also sometimes I'm going to sound like a really bad adventurer. Like head torches don't really work for me. I find them very annoying and frustrating. And so I generally just use my phone light if I'm walking at night and tuck it into like my hip belt around my waist. And then that gives me enough light and it's lower down. So it's not like coming from my head, which I don't like. So yeah, I use it as a head torch as well. So yeah.
I like that.
Phone, gear, yeah. Love it. Oh my God.
And using it for flight. It's funny. My wife and I were on a trail in Hawaii, and I was calculating, you know, we didn't think we could get clear. We were going to the Nepali coast, and so we were halfway there, and I was looking at the time, and I was like, we're running out of time. And my wife says, how much charge do you have left in your phone? And I said, like, you know, 30%. She goes, oh, we've got enough. We can use the phones for lights on the way back. And so we went ahead and pressed on and saw a gorgeous sunset. And it was like, so yes, I agree. You know, having that as a light source is a great tool. We used it to hike, you know,
I would say, do you have your phone? I have mine in a life proof case as well, which is like waterproof, dustproof, drop proof. Like, cause I was like riding along on the Pacific coast, like if I drop my phone when I'm cycling, it doesn't matter. Cause it would literally just bounce in the life proof case. So yeah, protect your phone at all costs. Yeah.
Well, yeah, if it's your most important piece of gear, you need to make
absolutely you. Yeah.
Okay,
forget the boots, forget the backpack, nope. It's the phone, that's what we're looking after.
Well, you know, some things is kind of a given. It's like, yeah, we'll count on that. But that's why I asked the question, you know, what is the thing that you you know kind of have as your primary thing that you're like, I've got to have this. So that's good. I like that. Second question is, in your adventures, what is the strangest thing you've ever seen out there on the trail?
Oh, what's the strangest thing I've ever seen? I don't even know if it's strange though. Like, is it, what's the strangest thing I've ever seen? I want to think about this. Sorry.
No, that's fine.
I'm going through the different animals I've seen, but I don't think like bears, snakes, porcupines, I don't think that's strange to see. I've seen odd buildings, odd statues, but that is that strange? No. I don't think I've got a good answer. I don't, it's strange. Strange thing I've seen. I think I just take it all in my stride. I don't ever think of that, oh, that's really strange or that's really odd. Now I wish I'd found something like really exciting to say. Strange. I got nothing. Okay. Sorry. Nothing. Well,
that's,
nothing.
That's yes. You're a very adaptable person. So.
I think I'd just be like, okay, right. Yeah, all right.
Well, that That's perfectly fine. So the last thing, what is your last question? What is your word or phrase that sums up your life philosophy?
Oh, at the moment, what it is show up, which is just very simple. But it is just, even when you don't fit, like, so I learned this on the Appalachian Trail, you know, if I wanted to make my deadline of walking in 100 days, like, I had to get up, even when it was raining, I was on my period, I felt awful, I was hungry, I was tired, I was wet. You just had to get up and show up every day, even if you think you're not doing a great job, even if you think you're not the best hiker, even if you think you're not making any progress, you still show up, you keep showing up day after day, and then you'll hit your goal. And so for me, that's it's almost like having good habits, you know, showing up when you, if you made a commitment, you show up, you go to the gym, you do your workout, you do your yoga, you do your stretching, you drink your water, you eat healthily. You know, you show up with your work. If you've made a commitment to other people, you deliver on that commitment. So yeah, just show up. Yeah.
I love that. That is actually a small, it seems like a small thing, but it is so important. It is so important. Yeah. To just show up. Thank you a lot, Sarah. Appreciate having you on the podcast.
Oh, no, thank you, Eric. It's been super fun. Although I still feel really bad that I can't answer that strange question. I think I do. I'm going to be walking now. When I'm walking or hiking, I'm going to be thinking back to you, thinking, right, I'm looking for something strange. I've got to think of a good story for, like, you know, a strange thing I've seen on trail. I'll make a note of it and I'll send you an email at some point. Hey, I'll be like, hey, Eric, I'm just on the Pacific Crest Trail. I've just come across, you'll never believe what I've seen. Something strange. Here you go. Yes. And here's a picture.
Do that. I'll release it as a special episode. as a bonus episode, follow up.
Yeah. Sarah's finally answered the question of something strange that she's discovered. Yeah.
In fact, I had one guest that after we'd stopped recording, it was about 5 minutes later, he goes, oh yeah. So I re-recorded that back on and put it in. But no, that's fine. I mean, that's not everybody has not everybody notices things as strange, but the question has been interesting as for some of my guests, because some people have had some very interesting, you know, things that they've said. I mean, my strange thing is not that big a deal. I was on a trail and I found a blue bandana laying in the middle of the trail flat, placed there. I mean, it hadn't dropped. It was placed there on purpose. And as I came upon it, it was in a diamond. So it was, you know, the square was offset 90 degrees. And later, and I looked at it and looked around and went, is there a camera around here? Someone, you know, it was a very small thing, but it was just strange to find this bandana laid in the middle of the trail. And so...
Did you ever find an answer for
No,
it?
Never. I mean, it's like I was out in the woods. There's nobody else was around. It was just.
Did you pick it up or did you leave it there?
Well, I picked it up and it was like, you know, that was kind of cool. So I actually put it. I actually had moved it. I placed it in the trail in a different spot. I thought somebody else run across this and have the same kind of pondering that I did.
Yeah. But, what's going on with this crazy bandana?
Yeah. When I've asked that question, I've had some interesting answers. One lady, she said she came upon a couple of people having sex in the, you know, right off the trail.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Just walk past, don't mind me, carry on.
She said that's what I did.
Good film.
She's like, I'm just going to keep going. Just keep, don't mind me.
Oh my God.
So, my grandson found a plane that crashed out. It was a little offshoot of the Appalachian Trail. He found this plane just crashed in the woods.
Wow.
So yeah, there are some strange things out there So that's why I asked the question, and like you will think of something, you know, it may be a year from now, but you will probably come up with an answer.
You could start a hashtag on Instagram, like strange things in the woods or something, like, you know, something, yeah. Other than people can just take photos and just be like, oh, this is what I found in the woods. Isn't this odd? Like, here's the plane crash, here's a bandana. No. Here's two people having sex. Don't take a photo of that.
My daughter ran across a lady on Instagram who had found a suitcase like 15 miles in the trail. I mean, and it was, and I can't remember, there was a whole thread. I mean, there was like, you know, hundreds of women were jumping in and commenting on this suitcase. I mean, it was like, not with a roller, and it was the old style, you know, had the handle and snaps and you know, clamshell type suitcase just laying out there in the middle of nowhere. And there's a whole, you know, back and forth and discussion. Do I open it? You might even be able to find it on Instagram, but my daughter was telling me about it. And it's like,
Did she open it?
I think she eventually opened it. I think she went back several times and, you know, it stayed there. It was on a trail that she had access to on a regular basis. And yeah. I think finally she opened it and it was just full of odds and ends and, you know, nothing.
Well, there's two other stories. One, which is, I met a guy when I was cycling down the Pacific Coast Highway, and he was cycling in Alaska. And when he was cycling along the road, he saw this brown bag. And it was quite a big brown bag. And so next to some other bits and bobs, and he stopped and he picked up the brown bag, and inside there was cash. There was like $5,000.
Oh my goodness.
So he kept it and he just carried on cycling with it. So that paid for his next bit of his trip. And then this other story is a bit weird. Like, it was like in an unsolved like murder mysteries or something. Mm-hmm. And basically someone was in the woods, and there'd been these massive forest fires, and there was a diver, like a full-on water, like wetsuit, tank, goggles, flippers on his feet and everything, in the tree, burned. And everyone was just like, how did he get there? And when they were scooping the water from the ocean to put out the fires, they'd obviously scooped up a diver and dropped him into the forest fires. And he obviously got caught in the trees. And then, so that would be strange, wouldn't it? That's a strange story, but how unfortunate would you be?
Like, goodness. I feel sorry for the guy who's diving. I mean, that just, oh my goodness.
Just bad luck, right?
You know. And think about if he wondered what, if he was, while he was in the bucket, would he know what had happened? You know, that would, terrifying few minutes, and then get, you know, dumped in the fire. He probably, the fall could have probably killed him. That's a sad story.
It is. Sorry about that. Ending on that cheerful note.
you never know where conversation is going to go. So, hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you know somebody who might like it as well, please take just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. And if you enjoy most of the episodes, please tell your friends. That's the best compliment you can give. I truly enjoy being able to spend time here with you each week, and I appreciate that you take the time to listen. If you have any comments, questions, or stories that you'd like to share, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run and you can leave a written or a voice message. You can also find the show notes for this episode and more at the same link, ultramindsetpodcast.run. Remember, it takes an ultramarathon mindset to go the distance in running and in life, and a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.